For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
We're calling this one Blindness for the reason that there are three scenes that make up the narrative, and they all have to do with blindness. So without further ado, let's just dive right into it. This is 2 Kings chapter 6, starting in verse 8, where it says that the king of Aram, this is the guy we talked about last week, and Aram is up in that little box there, which is where modern-day Syria is. Damascus is its capital. And they have kind of a love-hate relationship going on with Israel. And in this narrative, it's gone from love to hate, but it'll end back in love again. So that's a good thing. The king of Aram was at war with Israel, and he would confer with his officers saying, "We will mobilize our forces at such and such a place." But immediately, Elisha, this guy we've been talking about, the prophet, the man of God, would warn the king of Israel of these plans. "Do not go to that place, for the Arameans are planning to mobilize their troops there," Elisha would say. So the king of Israel would send word to the place indicated by Elisha, urging them to be prepared for the attack. So the king of Aram became very angry, and he called his officers together and demanded to know, "Which of you is the traitor? Who has been telling the king of Israel about my plans?" "It's not us, my lord the king," one of the officers replied. And Elisha, "One of the prophets in Israel tells the king of Israel, even the words you speak in the privacy of your bedroom." Ooh, it's a lot of knowledge there. "Go and find out where he is," the king commanded, "and so I can send troops to seize him." And so this report came back to the king. Elisha is in Dothan. So one night the king of Aram sent a great army with many chariots and horses to surround the city. And when Elisha's servant got up early the next morning and went outside, he saw the troops, the horses and chariots everywhere. "Oh, my lord, what will we do now?" the young man cried out to Elisha, just realizing we're totally surrounded. There are no walls in the city of Dothan that we know of, so they were completely vulnerable in every respect. But Elisha says, "Don't be afraid, for there are many more on our side than on theirs." Then Elisha prayed, "Oh Lord, open his eyes and let him see." And then the Lord opened the young man's eyes, and when he looked up, he saw that the hillside around Elisha was filled with horses and chariots of fire. As the Aramean army advanced toward him, Elisha prayed, "Oh Lord, please strike them blind." So the Lord struck them with blindness as Elisha had asked. Then Elisha went out and told them, "You've come to the wrong place. This isn't the right city. Follow me and I'll take you to the man you're looking for." And so they led him to the city of Samaria, which is the capital of Israel. And as soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, "Oh Lord, open their eyes and let them see." So the Lord opened their eyes and they discovered that they were in the middle of Samaria. Probably not a good thing. When the king of Israel saw them, he shouted to Elisha, "My father, should I kill them?" I mean, here they are. Here's the army of the enemy right here. Blind as a bat, twice as dumb. And Elisha says, "Of course not. Do we kill prisoners of war? Give them food and water and send them back to their master." So the king of Israel made a great feast for the Arameans and sent them home to their master. And after that, the Aramean raiders stay away from the land of Israel. The first of the three scenes, I want to just break down each one of them and talk about this issue of blindness and different facets, actually, of what blindness actually means in the narrative and in the Bible more generally. We note first that the Aramean king, while really consumed with his plan, was pretty much blind to the plans of God. It says, "Who's been informing the king of Israel about my plans?" And so there's a certain sort of focus that this guy's got that is rooted in blind ambition. That's really what he's about. He's about his plan, his thing, his agenda, what he wants to get done, and he sees the world really through that lens and pretty much exclusively through that lens. And blind ambition, of course, is a problem for all of us, and for some of us more so, I think, than others, who are real ambition-oriented, who are outcomes-oriented, who have their plans and who are doing their thing. But when we talk about ambition, isn't necessarily a bad thing in itself. To be goal-centered is a good thing. But blind ambition is something that is really a condition of the soul, and we could define it like this. It's taking the opportunity without regard to broader questions of purpose or morality or long-term effects or other people. And this is really where the king of Aram was. That was his ambition. It's really close to what the Greeks talked about when they referred to hubris, this idea of tragic pride. It's like, here's this person with a lot of ability and a definite agenda, a game plan. But what they don't understand is that there is a weakness that they don't even recognize within themselves. And that weakness is going to foil their plans. It's going to bring them to ruin. And so it is, this is Icarus right here, who decided that he is going to learn to fly. And so he engineered wings like a bird. And up he went into the sky. But he got too close to the sun and the wax that held the feathers together in his wings began to melt. And he crashed to his death. Pride. And so it is that we find here's this man who is taken over and driven by his own pride, his own ambition, not realizing that he is unable to see the most important thing that he needs to see. That seeing in this sense is really a condition of the soul. Think about where this guy is at in context. What does he know already and what has he heard that might shape his plans, but to no avail because of his pride? He knows, for instance, the testimony of Naaman, the guy that we talked about last week. Naaman says, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. This is his chief of staff. This is a guy close to the king, personal. And so for Naaman to know that this is true and to communicate this to the king of Aram means that that king had to have been pretty dense to think about continuing the attack on Israel, knowing that the man that he trusts with his own army is telling him that the real power, the gods that we worship, are nothing in comparison to the God of Israel. And then, too, the fact that his own servant says, Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel, the words that you speak in your bedroom, that ought to give pause to anyone's plan. Think about that. If we were just to give away all of our battle plans to the enemy before we attacked, we might want to be thinking twice or more about launching that assault, right? But not when you're blinded by your own ambitions, as this guy was. And again, it seems to me that this is not an uncommon problem. Think about the way the Proverbs puts it. There's a way that appears to be right, but in the end, leads to death. And so it is that we can be all about our own ego agenda, our own plan for life. This is what I want to accomplish for me. And it just means that, and we're just, because of that, unable to see reality for what it truly is. How common it is that we listen only to the voices we want to hear. I think probably that is more true today than it has ever been in the history of humankind. Our technology has developed in such a way that you can connect with voices all over the place who exactly agree with everything you think. And what has happened in our society, of course, is that it has just fragmented us into a bunch of isolated bubbles who agree with one another, who reinforce one another's outlook, and so that there's no real sharing of ideas that goes on. And we become ignoranter and ignoranter because we have shaped our whole understanding of reality only by the biases of those who read things the same way that we do. It's a significant problem. And it's a spiritual problem because there are real consequences to not being willing to lay your thinking and your values and your priorities open even to those who would disagree with you and to really mix it up. I was thinking about, how do you describe what the proverb is talking about here? There is a way that appears to be right, but whose end is death. I was thinking about friends of Linda and mine some years ago. They were getting married, and we had an opportunity to meet the guy's family down in the Cincinnati area. And the mom was, I don't know, mid-50s-ish, something like that. And she was kind of a heavy smoker. And I think at that point in time, she had already had part of one of her lungs cut out because of smoking. But smoking she continued to do. And at the wedding, we in New York City, we're up in this really cool hotel and looked out over the city. It was really cool, and she was still smoking. And she said, yeah, you know, the fact about smoking that people don't realize is that when you smoke, you're breathing in all this smoke, right? And it just kills all the bacteria and viruses that would hurt you in your lungs. I said, really? That's news to me. She was dead a couple of years later. Is it possible that you and me are the same as this woman? Is it possible that we have... are driven by our own ambitions, our own pride, and our own agenda to such an extent that we don't really are not able to really hear the voice of clarity or sanity, the voice of God Himself? That would be a terrible condition to be in, but one which the Bible describes is really the condition of humanity in general. Jesus, citing Isaiah, puts it this way. He says, you'll keep on hearing, but you won't understand. You'll keep on seeing, but you will not perceive. For, he says, the heart of this people has become dull. It's an interesting thing to consider here. When we think about the intellect, think about being rational, we tend to view that as a sort of like, you know, a computer's rational, human beings are rational, we're just processing information. But the reality is that none of us think, and even in our rational thoughts, we don't think in isolation from the rest of who we are as people. And so there is motivated reasoning, motivated listening, motivated seeing that goes on all the time. We tend to reason from a perspective. And so no matter how intelligent we might be, there is something that our reason is protecting. Protecting an outlook that is important to us. Protecting our ego, perhaps. Protecting our autonomy. What Jesus is saying right here, citing Isaiah, is that we have motivated reasoning that keeps God at a distance from us. I've spent a lot of my life, my adult life, interacting at a significant level with people a lot smarter than I am, and trying to interact with them about the truth, about Christianity. And what I get so often is, you know, well, you know, harumph, harumph, that's interesting for you, but I'm not interested, or I don't know, I really wonder about that, or even still, you know, it's kind of been settled long ago that there's no such thing as God, and why believe in Him like you'd believe in the Easter Bunny or Santa Claus or whatever. And I have found myself really thinking about the fact that no matter how intelligent a person is, their intelligence is filtered through a grid. So I've asked myself this question. Is the skeptic sufficiently skeptical of their own skepticism? And which is, I think, a pretty important point, actually. You say, well, I don't know about God. Okay, so are you saying that you can't know or that you don't know? Well, God? Yeah, you can't know about God. Well, how do you know that you can't know? You ever asked that question? How do you know that you can't know? Well, you can't put him in a test tube and measure him or this or that. And I'm like, well, okay, so, but we know all kinds of things, don't we, that aren't measurable by our senses. And we accept that those things are actual and truths about them are reasonable, right? Yeah, well, then why would God, the purported author of creation and all things that we do see and know, be himself unknowable? And so, you know, even in principle, that doesn't seem to be the case. And so what the conversation usually devolves down to is, well, I don't know. I can't say. To which it's important, I think, to say, well, would you like to know? There is information that I can that we can share together that might connect with you and help build an actual understanding of the fact that there is a God who loves you, a God who continues to pursue you. And that's a different kind of conversation altogether. But I think it's important, again, just to recognize how not wholly objective any of us really are with our reasoning, that we are motivated reasoners. This is the kind of thing that is being described here. God's plan is hidden in plain sight. Yeah, that's right. So, for hundreds of years before the time of Christ, there are these clear and unambiguous predictions. When God will send his Messiah into the world, that's Daniel chapter 9. What he will accomplish when he is on the earth, that's Isaiah chapter 52 verse 13 through the end of chapter 53. It will describe where he will come from, where he's born, Micah chapter 5 and verse 2. A whole framework of understanding of who God's Messiah is going to be. And then, sure enough, he shows up. And how is he greeted? By the humanity that he's come to save. Not well. Strung up. Put to death. But Paul makes a super interesting observation in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 that really relates to this whole issue of this spiritual blindness that we're describing. He says that none of the rulers of this age had understood God's wisdom, because had they understood it, they never would have crucified the Lord of glory. In other words, all the information was there, but there was no interest in really thinking it through, in processing it. Even though Jesus cites all of these passages throughout his teaching ministry about himself as the Messiah. He even says, I'm going to be betrayed, I'm going to be put to death, and in 3 days rise again from the dead. No one believed the scriptures about him or his own clear pronouncement about himself. And Paul says, the rulers of this age, that is, and he's referring here, I think, not just to the physical rulers of Rome and among Jews, but also the spiritual rulers that kind of stand behind the events of history. Because what happened in the cross of Christ had very direct bearing on all of them. In the cross of Christ, God deals with the fundamental problem of the fact that he is just, that he is a moral God, and as such must hold a rebellious humanity accountable for our inhumanity towards one another, towards ourselves and our defiance of God. And on the other hand, that God also loves the creation that he made to such an extent that he would do anything to deal with the human dilemma. And it is in the cross of Christ that these two incredible things come together, where the justice of God is fully served in placing upon Christ the burden of all of our guilt so that he could demonstrate his love for us. And that's just not something that God's observers over millennia could make any sense out of. It's just the idea that we are so suspicious in our hearts about who is God, that no one, even with the clearest warning signs from Christ himself and from the testimony of the Old Testament prophets, No one could really digest that information because of the deeply distorted, hostile heart that exists between ourselves and God. And that's how Christ goes to the cross with the full consent and approval of the plans of humanity, only to complete his own purpose through our free choice to rebel against God. That's the wisdom of God. So, first then we meet the blindness of ambition. Second, there's the fact that there's a blindness to the presence of God. And this focuses really on that second scene of Elisha and his servant who recognize that they're now surrounded by the Aramean army. Elisha says, "The Lord opened the young man's eyes to see something that he was unable to see the story behind the story, the reality behind the physical." And so, we asked you this question that apparently turned out a lot better on my computer monitor than on this screen. What do you see? This is a wood carving from the 16th century. You got it, wood carver, Albrecht Dürer. What does it look like? Can anyone tell what that is? It's a landscape. And so you got this little village in the middle of the landscape, and everything is peaceful and nice, and that's the kind of place I'd like to live. I don't know about you. But Dürer, making the same point that Elisha is making here, takes a step back to look at what's really going on, to see that, yes, there is this idyllic little scene, but above it is a massive spiritual battle that is being waged over the condition of humanity, and how will God deal with the problems of a broken and alienated humanity, a humanity at war with one another and under his judgment. And it is in that context that a real battle is taking place, the decisive battle. The real battle is over the unseen things, the condition of our soul that manifests itself in how we deal with one another in the physical world. And so Elisha is giving his servant a little bit of an open window to see what is really going on around. The author of Hebrews, in reflecting on Moses and the Exodus, says, "By faith Moses left Egypt not fearing the wrath of the king, because he endured as seeing him who is unseen." And it's just kind of an interesting point that's being made here about Moses. It's the idea that Egypt was an opportunity to see God's hand because God had promised. Because God had promised that he would deliver Israel and bring them to the land that he promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that he would give them, that Moses was able to see him who was unseen. He was able to, in other words, put the full weight of his confidence behind what God had said, and as a result, was able to see the hand of God working in history. But it's the confidence that precedes the confirmation that the author of Hebrews is bringing to it. That the idea here is that to truly see, there is involved a matter of faith, just as blindness also has a measure of human corruption and spiritual deadness and inertness. We read on in Psalm 5:3, "In the morning, O Lord, you will hear my voice. In the morning, I'll order my prayer to you." And then he concludes, "and eagerly watch." I think that's interesting. Eagerly watch. So I'm in prayer. And that prayer that I bring to the Lord, the concerns of my day, the people I know I'm going to be involved with, the things that I'm seeking to accomplish, and I bring those before the throne of God, and then I wait with a sense of expectation. How will God manifest himself in these conversations I'm going to have, the things that I'm studying or working or whatever that might be? It's a prayer that is so important here, because it's a call to us to look for those things that God is doing, and to have that sense and that honest, clear sense that God, you know, there's a relationship that is built over time as I pray and watch. And then I see God working, and I pray and watch and see God working, that over time we begin to develop vision. We begin to develop a sense of true expectation of what God is going to do. And that is a kind of confident vision that is just awesome to be able to really sense and discern the reality of what God is doing in our world and in our life. Sometimes God works at times we don't expect, and in ways that we can't understand until much later in life. I was thinking about this in a couple of weeks. We have some good friends coming from Africa to stay with us for a couple of weeks, and to introduce them to you and to the rest of our fellowship. And these partners of ours have gone through some real significant struggles in their life and in their work since they became a church and a small network of churches throughout West Africa. They've undergone two civil wars that have decimated their churches. And in 2011... the main church that kind of is the hub of the wheel of all their work in the Ivory Coast went from a group of nearly 2,000 to a group of less than 300. People were killed. They were slaughtered. They were spread out all over the place. They were lost. There was a published hit list of Protestant pastors that were to be taken out by the insurgency, and our partners were on that list, and they fled into the jungle as their wives continued the work of the churches that they had started. It's a pretty remarkable story. But what makes it really interesting and germane to our conversation here is that at the end of that process, by 2014, as they were allowed to return to their churches and to their ministries, as broken as they were, they realized something vitally important. Well, they realized two things. One, the power of female leadership, which is not something that's really a part of that culture, which they had come to depend upon and continue to this day to depend upon. Significant. And the second was the understanding that they could not do church as they had done for the last 15 years before. To be structurally visible in a community is dangerous. They realized that what they need to do is to create a network of things on the down low, in houses, in small gatherings that don't attract much attention. And they began doing that, and we began to partner in that endeavor just a few years ago. And the fascinating thing about that is that they are now, they were reduced to less than 2,000 people nationwide in their movement. Today they're up to almost 8,000. That they are able to see today that they are able to penetrate into communities, into villages and places, not just in their own country, but regionally in southern Mali and Benin and Togo and other places that are around them that they would never have been able to do before. And they look back, not with gratitude for what they had suffered, but with an understanding that God was with them, and that they learned what they needed to learn to take that great next step forward in their service to God. And I think that's the way it works. When we order, when we pray and we order our prayers to God, and we watch and we say, what's happening? God is a part of this. He's not causing all these things to happen, but he's working in them and through them. And he's got a purpose, and if we are mindful of the purposes of God, then we're going to be able to be led by him, be able to take that next step of faith as we trust in his guidance for us. Not too long ago, we were in a clinic in central Ethiopia, and there were blind people there. And in Ethiopia, they lead blind people with a cane. No, not like in their hand, in somebody else's hand. The blind person holds a cane that's held by the person who's leading them, guiding them around. It's a real kind of picture of faith. They trust implicitly their guide. And then they get to understand what the layout of the land is, how this whole thing works. And that, in a lot of ways, that's kind of the life of faith that God has called us to. We begin to understand and see things from God's perspective as we entrust our lives to him and follow. And we begin to see things coming together for us in ways that are, when you look back, remarkable. And you see the hand of God and the tapestry that your life has become. Now, let's move to our last point here, the last of our three scenes. And so here, whereas the first scene is addressed to the Aramean king, the second to the prophet's servant, the third is directed to the king of Israel. The king of Israel sees his enemies literally blindly coming into his presence in his capital. So now he's got his whole army around. Here would be a great opportunity to destroy your enemy, right? What better opportunity could there be? Should I kill them, the king says to the prophet. And the prophet, of course, is reading from a different page and sees things very differently and says, of course not. Of course not. These are prisoners of war. They're not combatants. No, we won't kill them. And in that kind of confusion on the king's part, he shows also another kind of blindness, namely a blindness to the grace of God. The grace of God, the mercy and compassion of God. He is a further illustration of what we could call the Jonah syndrome. And maybe if you know, Jonah was a prophet of a generation after this, who God raised up to go to Nineveh, the capital of the empire of Assyria, to denounce them and to pronounce God's judgment on this city. And so Jonah, instead of going northeast to Nineveh, goes southwest to the coast, to a town called Tarshish, where it says that he went down to Tarshish, down to the dock, down to the ship, down to the base of the ship. He's going down. Okay, this guy is clearly heading south. And so God, you know, is you can't run from God. You can try, but it's futile, and at a certain point, you'll find yourself, like Jonah, as low as you can get, at the base of the sea, where God then, you know, rescues Jonah and has him thrown up on the land, literally, and reluctantly then marches to Nineveh to walk around the city wall, uttering his words of judgment. And to everyone's dismay, the king of Nineveh and the royalty come together. They tear their robes. They throw on sackcloth, which is this like really uncomfortable, scratchy thing. It would just be a real drag, especially in the summer, to have on, and cover themselves with ashes to show their shame. And God, of course, does not judge that city. And this really pisses Jonah off. It's like, these guys are our enemy. And God's like, I know they are your enemy. And they have this confrontation at the end of chapter 3 and into chapter 4, where in verse 2, Jonah kind of puts the whole thing together. And he says, in order to forestall this, namely forestalling the judgment of God on the nation, on the city of Nineveh, he said, I fled to Tarshish, for I knew. Now he's quoting Exodus chapter 34, verse 6. And he says, I knew God, and I'm not happy about it, that you are gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, abounding in loving kindness, this loyal love. And he says, one who relents concerning calamity. When people, when I announce a word of judgment and people hear it and they're like, oh my God, and they return to God, then it's like, okay. That word of judgment has served its purpose. You've turned from that and you've turned to me. And Jonah's like, you know, that's what I knew would happen. That was the risk of this whole thing. That's why I didn't want to go in the first place. And that's kind of like a picture of Israel's history of this period. A total disregard for three things. First, a disregard for who they are. And so we go back to the law itself, which says, the Lord did not set his love on you or choose you because you were more numerous than any of the peoples. He says, for you are the fewest of all people, like namely one, Abraham. But because the Lord loved you and kept the oath that he swore to your forefathers. In other words, you know, you're nothing of significance. You're nothing to get that excited about. Your significance comes from the fact that you are beloved of God. That's the issue here. Never forget who you are. Second, never forget why you're here. The purpose of God's calling you. And we see, we read in Genesis 12, verse 3, as he makes his promise to Abraham, the father of these people, in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And he makes it clear in the law that is their purpose. And in Genesis 18, verses 18 and 19, Abraham will surely become a great and mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. God's intent for Israel was never Israel in its own right, isolated from other nations, but Israel as God's chosen people to be God's agents for God's global reach. I have chosen him so that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing justice, so that the Lord may bring upon Abraham which he had spoken about him. That's the purpose. To be blessed, to be a blessing. This is the pattern. This is how God works. He calls people to him. He blesses them so that they can then turn around and be an agent of God's blessing on others. And this, again, is just in the general, the framework of the scriptures themselves, which thirdly tell us that God is the God of the nations. And so if you've been with us in our study of 1 and 2 Kings, you'll note a very peculiar pattern. That the people who seem to really understand the God of Israel are not Israelites. The significant narratives, the woman that Elijah met in Zarephath up near Sidon, is the one who recognizes the truth of the word of the Lord in the mouth of the prophet. Last week we talked about Naaman, the chief of the army of this very man, the king of Aram, that we're talking about here tonight, who went and sought the help of Israel and Israel's God to be healed of his leprosy, and concludes that there is no God anywhere but in Israel. Israel, who is at this time worshiping a pantheon of fertility gods, and only incidentally, and in very small numbers, the one true God. It really reflects, again, God's global purposes, his concern for the all of the nations. And so we read in Psalm 87, verses 4 and 5, I count Egypt and Babylon among those who know me, Philistia and Tyre, even distant Ethiopia. They have become citizens of Jerusalem. They are in. They count. They're my people. Egypt and Babylon. Egypt enslaved them. Babylon in 586 destroyed them. the people of Philistia are the very people that we're describing here as enemies of Israel and of Tyre, from which this horrible Baalistic cult came. And all of these people who were formerly enemies become brothers and sisters in the presence of God. That's his plan. We read in Isaiah 19, this incredible teaching. In that day, this day when God brings history to its conclusion, Israel will be third party with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, "Blessed is Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance." And this, my friends, is astonishing. Here is the prophet saying the same thing as the psalmist. He's saying that of these great enemies of Israel, Egypt, and Assyria that destroys the 10 northern tribes in 720 BC, people who most certainly do not have God's interests in mind or the interests of God's people in mind, enemies in that sense, God has concern. God continues to pursue. So scandalous were these words of Isaiah that when the Hebrew Old Testament was translated into Greek and also translated into Aramaic, the language of the people of the first century, well, I'll just let Michael Fishbane, the great Hebrew scholar, describe it. He says, such a designation of Egypt, my people, Syria, the work of my hands, used pointedly of Israel. This is God's covenant language to his people. You're unique among all the peoples of the earth. You're my inheritance. You're my people. He said, such a designation like that, that Isaiah brings back in Isaiah chapter 19, weighed heavily on ancient Jewish translators, unable to tolerate such theological paradox. How could God address my enemies this way? The Septuagint and Targum traditions renationalized the Hebrew text and substituted Israel for Egypt. They literally changed the text because they could not imagine a God who loved that way. In the 20th century, we've seen a very difficult era for Israel. And so, in the Holocaust, 6 million or more European Jews were destroyed. And one who was able to leave Prague shortly before the war and was himself saved from the slaughter of the Jews, but his family was not. Everyone in his family died in the Holocaust. And as a rabbi, as a student of the Old Testament scriptures, was forced to agonize within his heart. How could this happen? To agonize in his mind. How could God let such a thing happen? What does this mean about God? And it drove him more deeply into the Hebrew scriptures. And about this passage that we're describing right here, Abraham Heschel says this: "The God of Israel is also the God of her enemies, without their knowing him, and despite their defying him. The enmity between the nations will turn to friendship in that day." That's a powerful level of understanding, of seeing things God's way, all the way down. May the Church of Jesus Christ in our day have that same sensitivity that Heschel described and demonstrated as he looked at the tragedy of his own experience, the experience of his family and his very people. Then later became a close, intimate associate of Martin Luther King as he began that crusade to bring justice to African Americans and poor people in the U.S. So, just to try to draw a string around things, The Elijah Elisha story is a chronicle of amazing grace. At every turn we've seen, the unexpected occurs. Those who should be right with God are shown their deep need for God and a call by the prophets to turn to Him. Those who we would expect to be far outside the concern of God are at the center of His focus. Why? Because the God of the Old Testament is the God of the New Testament. The God of the Scriptures is a God of amazing grace, of generosity. And my great hope for you, as you've been a part of this series that we've been conducting here now for the last couple of months, is that it would clarify in your mind the intent of God for you. He loves you. God is pursuing you. God is simply asking you to set aside what's in your hands so that you can come to Him with the open hands of faith to say, God, be merciful to me. I don't deserve it. And if we would just come to God that way, recognizing perhaps in a poignant moment that we're out of excuses and we're out of resources and we're just tired of pushing against God, tired of justifying ourselves, just tired. We would take this time, even here tonight, just to turn to God and say, thank you for your great love for me in Jesus Christ. Thank you that you took upon yourself the burden of my guilt so that I can be in relationship to you as a son or as a daughter. The story of Elijah and Elisha in this great text is really the story of amazing grace. I was blind, but now I see.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.